Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobby Jean Schweitzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of publications that appear in the September 2020 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Alan F. Stempel. Dr. Stempel is the first author of an article titled Preoperative Fluid Fasting Times and Post-Induction Low Blood Pressure in Children, a Retrospective Analysis. Dr. Stempel is Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology and Critical Care at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Welcome, Dr. Stempel.
Hello. Thanks very much for inviting me to take part in this podcast. I'm really honored to participate.
And joining Dr. Stempel is Dr. Laszlo Vuckitz. Dr. Vuckitz wrote an accompanying editorial, Fluid Fasting in Children. Dr. Vuckitz is Senior Consultant Pediatric Anesthesiologist in the Department of Anesthesiology, Pharmacology, and Intensive Care at the University Hospital of Geneva in Geneva, Switzerland. Welcome, Dr. Vuckitz.
Hello, this is Laszlo, and very happy for participating in this discussion.
So, Dr. Stempel, let's start with you first. Can you tell us how you went about doing this study?
Sure. My colleagues and I performed a single-center retrospective study of anesthetized children without pre-induction venous access who underwent surgery between January 2016 and September 2017 at our hospital. What we did is we took the electronic medical record data and analyzed it, focusing on patient and anesthesia-related factors as well as systolic blood pressure values and clear fluid fasting duration.
And can you tell us a bit more about the patient demographics? I know you mentioned they were children, but were these all age groups? And what was the setting? I think a lot of us are probably familiar here in the United States with the hospital that you're at, but give us a little bit more information about that for our other listeners. And also maybe touch on the numbers of patients that you enrolled.
Certainly. Our study included patients who were less than 18 years of age, were ASA physical status 1, 2, 3, or 4, and had a recorded time of last clear fluid intake on the day of the anesthetic. We excluded inpatients, patients undergoing cardiac procedures, and had a few other exclusion criteria aimed at trying to exclude patients who might have received intravenous fluids prior to the induction of anesthesia. The setting of the study was the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. It's a freestanding quaternary care pediatric hospital located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And the study included 15,543 patients in total.
And what was the question or dilemma that you were trying to address?
Well, our study was aimed at answering two questions. Number one, what is the incidence of low blood pressure in children right after induction of anesthesia? And we divided that time into anesthesia preparation and surgical preparation epochs. And our second question was, is clear fluid fasting duration associated with post-induction low blood pressure in either or both of those epochs?
Dr. Vuckitz, what do we already know about the duration of fasting and outcomes in pediatric patients?
Well, we actually know very little about the association between fasting and clinically relevant endpoints in pediatric patients, and that was one of the main reasons why we were happy to consider this study in our journal. The reason why we don't know much about this is that we do not really know, or at least we do not agree upon what are the relevant outcome measures in this context of fasting. And there is some literature focusing on the rate of gastric emptying after liquid or food ingestion in children. There are also some on patient and parent satisfaction in function of fasting times, and some studies using small number of patients also indicate that prolonged fasting times could be associated with hypertension. But clearly, this particular study from Dr. Stempel and his collaborators, by far the most important one so far, showing an association between fasting times and hypotension as an endpoint, whatever hypotension might mean in this population.
Thank you. So Dr. Simhao, can you tell us how hypotension was defined? I think this is maybe a little trickier in the pediatric population than it is for those of us who practice more with adults. And as I recall, you actually changed the primary outcome of this study after the paper was originally submitted. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
You're correct. Yes, we did start with a definition based on a study published by Dr. Nephew and colleagues in 2009. And that study reported among pediatric anesthesiologists, there is great variability in blood pressure parameters and thresholds used to define and treat intraoperative hypotension. In that study, the majority of respondents considered a 20 to 30% reduction from baseline blood pressure as significant hypotension. So our initial submission used that definition, that 20% decrease from baseline systolic blood pressure as the primary outcome. And using that definition, we found rates of hypotension in the 40 to 50% range across the two epochs. And as you can imagine, the editor and reviewers rightfully questioned the clinical relevance of a primary outcome with such high rates. And based on their helpful feedback, we changed the primary outcome to a definition of low blood pressure based on reference normograms for non-invasive blood pressures in anesthetized children. Those normograms were published by Dr. DeGraff and colleagues in 2016 and were based on multi-center electronic medical record data in various age groups.
Very interesting. I don't think I've ever noticed that in a previous paper, but it makes perfect sense as to why you wanted to try to make sure the outcome was clinically meaningful, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And the challenge with pediatric patients and trying to define hypotension is that articles have used both the relative definition of hypotension, a percent change from baseline, or absolute values as substantiated by measures of decreased cerebral blood flow or decreased cerebral oxygenation. And in this study, we tried and approached initially with the notion of relative hypotension and then adjusted our outcome based, again, on the helpful feedback.
So I guess peer review is not always just a torture.
No, in this case, it was extremely helpful, and we actually thought we're actually quite impressed with the quality of the comments and the helpful feedback and the suggestions to improve our analysis. We were actually we found it to be an interesting and exciting challenge, and we're happy that in the end it produced a far superior study.
Well, that's good to hear, and I'm sure music to the ears of some of our listeners who may have been through that peer review process themselves. Dr. Vutskets, as our listeners likely know, over the last decade or so, I think we have accumulated evidence that perioperative hypotension or low blood pressures are dangerous in adults and associated with such outcomes as acute kidney injuries and cardiac events, among others. But do we know if hypotension is harmful in pediatric patients?
Well, probably such as in adults, hypertension is bad. But as Alan also pointed out, the only problem is that we do not really know what hypertension is in children. Or if I put it in other words, we don't really know what are the blood pressure ranges that can maintain normal physiological function during the perioperative period. The thing is, compared to adults, is that the incidence of acute kidney injury or any cardiac events are very, very low in general pediatric populations. And that's why it's very difficult to demonstrate how any given blood pressure value could correlate with adverse events. So there is clearly a huge space for research in this domain in pediatrics.
Dr. Simhao, you mentioned how you looked at blood pressures during two separate time periods. I think in the paper you said epoch one and epoch two. So why don't you just tell us actually how these periods were defined, the specific events that you actually were able to, I guess, code off of the electronic records, and why you chose to do the study in this fashion?
Yes, we did look at blood pressures during two separate time periods between the induction of anesthesia and the start of surgery. At our institution, we typically perform an inhalational induction, obtain vascular access, and perform airway management, after which clinicians record an anesthesia-ready event in the electronic health record system. And as most anesthesia clinicians can attest, all three of those portions of that time period can be stimulating for the patient. It's after that anesthesia-ready event timestamp that surgical preparation begins. And that epoch or phase is a much less stimulating period of surgical prep and draping, performing the surgical timeout, and everything that goes into the preparation prior to incision. And we'd actually, in a previous study of hypotension in infants, we'd observed higher rates of hypotension during the surgical preparation phase when compared to the anesthesia preparation phase, and we call the surgical prep nadir. So we took the same approach in the current study.
Can you tell us a bit more about the fasting durations of the patients in your study? And did you like simply look at before and after midnight, or you actually looked at the actual time courses?
We did look at the time interval that we calculated between the patient or caregiver reported time of last fluid intake and the time of induction of anesthesia. And that's how we calculated the fasting durations of the patients in our study, by the induction time minus the reported time of last intake.
And Dr. Vutskets, what fasting durations are typically recommended by guidelines, and do these differ among countries?
Well, yes, they do. Traditional guidelines, like the current ASA guidelines, they usually recommend a two-hour-long fasting period for free liquids. Now we have the new European guidelines. They advocate for 1 hour. But it is important to say that, at least in this context, that there is no solid evidence backing any of these recommendations, because there is a very low incidence of adverse events related to bronchoaspiration in children.
Dr. Sempel, what are the guidelines at the CHOP?
Well, our guidelines at the time of the study were actually clear fluid up to 2 hours before the induction of anesthesia. Since then, our institution has changed to a 1 hour clear fluid fasting guideline, and are currently engaged in a quality improvement initiative to study rates of aspiration and rates of hypotension and other issues or concerns that might arise from shortening that time interval. However, we have, for the most part, tried to align our practice with the guidelines released by various international societies for pediatric anesthesia, suggesting briefer clear fluid fasting durations are better for our patients and also still as safe.
That's interesting. I may be wrong, but as I recall, the ASA guidelines for fasting are not separate for pediatric or adult patients, correct?
They are for both pediatric and adult patients, and they do not do any difference between the two. And even for free fluids, it's up to 2 hours.
Right. That's what I recall as well. So, Dr. Sempel, did you look at individual ages or groups of children by certain ages?
We grouped the patients by age into six groups based on sort of national guidelines for standard age groups for pediatric trials. You know, less than 6 months, 6 months to 1 year, 1 to 2 years, 2 to 5 years, 6 to 11, and then 12 to 18. And those groups also sort of evolved over the course of the editor and reviewer feedback of our manuscript.
Got it. So I guess let's find out what you found in this study. Can you tell us, please?
Sure. We found no association between clear fluid fasting time and low blood pressure during that stimulating anesthesia preparation epoch. However, during the surgical preparation period, we found and observed a significant yet nonlinear association between clear fluid fasting time and low blood pressure.
Interesting. So, Dr. Vutskets, were you surprised by the findings of Dr. Sempel's study, and especially this part about that the fasting was associated with low blood pressures only in that surgical preparation period?
Well, I was not particularly surprised. But it's always good to see after a big study if what we think reflects reality. And the way Dr. Simpa and his colleagues define the time periods, that means the immediate post-induction period that correlates with instrumentation of the airway, line placement, and so on, these are potentially noxious stimuli leading to activation of the sympathetic nervous system. And the second period prior to surgery is much cooler, so autonomous activation is probably less. That's, for me at least, the most plausible explanation of these differences.
Mm-hmm. Just about, did you analyze duration of hypotension, or was simply one blood pressure less than the target value recorded as hypotension?
It was the latter. So we defined hypotension as simply one blood pressure measurement less than the sex and age-specific value from the reference normograms, and that was two standard deviations below the 50th percentile for, again, the a sex and age-specific value from the reference normogram. We did not analyze duration of hypotension in this study.
So do you agree with Dr. Vizcatz's conclusion about the differences between those two different time periods and the association with hypotension? Or do you have other thoughts?
I do. I think that approaching the data in this fashion was to try to capture the and compare the stimulating portion of induction of anesthesia in children versus that quiescent, less stimulating portion. And I agree that there certainly is and does appear to be sympathetic stimulation during the active portion, and then that seems to quiet down and decrease during the surgical preparation phase.
So were you able to determine what types of fluids and how much patients consumed preoperatively?
Unfortunately, that was one of the limitations of our study. Our institution does not collect type of fluids or ask about the volume that patients believe they've consumed preoperatively. So we were unable to include those factors in our analysis.
So Dr. Vizcatz, you know, we've heard what may be somewhat surprising, I think, to some of our listeners, that places are moving to just a one-hour fasting for clear liquids in children. But I've actually heard of some places that allow very young children to continue clear liquids up until actually going into the operating room. Can you tell us a little bit about what evidence we do have on gastric emptying in children? I think you mentioned that we don't really have a lot of information on aspiration, but tell us what we know about just, are children different than adults, how quickly they can empty clear liquids?
To respond to the first part of the questions, there are several places where clear food fasting is not a common practice, but they let children drink until the entrance of the OR. And I personally, although we have the one-hour-long guidelines, I will not postpone surgery if the child has had a glass of water like 30 or 15 minutes before surgery. Now, the thing is, there is even literature being published on the low and comparable incidence to traditional fasting times in terms of bronchoaspiration with this practice when we do not have a fasting time. Now, if the question is if there is a good evidence for gastric emptying in children, I would say not exactly, because there are detailed studies on gastric emptying in children, but most of them have been done in non-anesthetized volunteers without the potential stress of the anticipated surgery. And, of course, we shouldn't forget that gastric emptying could be significantly delayed in case of pain and stress. And we do not have this kind of detailed observation in children. But at least in non-anesthetized volunteers, which is quite comparable to adult volunteers, in 15 to 30 minutes after ingestion, the clear fluids are getting through the stomach. But again, the thing is that if we look into bronchoaspiration as an outcome, the incidence is very low, even in the absence of strong scientific evidence for gastric emptying. And the incidence is very low, and also the consequences, in contrast to adults, are mostly minor for bronchoaspiration.
Good information. Dr. Semhal, from your study, do you think you can recommend an ideal fasting time, or at least one that perhaps is too long?
Yes, I think that if a clinician's goal is to minimize post-induction hypotension in anesthetized children, then from our study, it appears that a clear fluid fasting duration less than 4 hours is ideal, and a duration of 12 hours or more certainly appears to be too long. That was one of the surprising aspects for us in analyzing our data, was just how many of our patients had fasting durations of 12 hours or more, and we all found that to be both surprising and a little bit upsetting. Of course, you know, this recommendation should be weighed against any clinician's concern about, as Dr. Vizcatz mentioned, of bronchoaspiration.
Were those patients more likely to have, like, surgeries in the afternoon or later? And was that because people were still saying things like, you know, NPO after midnight as instructions?
Yes. The majority of the patients, so this analysis wasn't included in our study, but it seemed that those patients with the longer fasting durations were those patients who happened to be scheduled for the afternoon, but the parents or caregivers had stop the patients from drinking or eating anything after midnight and had not allowed them to have any clear fluid the morning of the procedure.
Hmm. Did you control for types and doses of anesthetic agents? And were patients having neuraxial techniques included, or were these all just straight general anesthetics?
We did attempt to control for at least types of anesthetic agents by factoring them into groups in our analysis. And this was, again, helpful feedback that we received from the reviewers and the editor. So we did include neuraxial techniques as one of the groups. And in our institution, neuraxial techniques are primarily caudal epidural placements after general anesthesia has been induced. Again, this was all carried out with helpful input from the editor and reviewers. Helped guide us to include these factors in our analysis, while also trying to manage, the heterogeneity in anesthetic management approaches, the timing and doses of medication. It was a real challenge to try to create some order from that chaos.
I can imagine. So Dr. Vutska, with this information from Dr. Sempal's study, should anesthesiologists be paying more attention to the fasting duration of our patients and be making adjustments in anesthetic management to mitigate these low blood pressures? Or do you think we need more information before changing practices?
I think that one of the main messages of this paper is that prolonged fasting times, and not just 1 or 2 hours, but like 4, 8, 12 hours, are associated with hypertension. So on a practical ground, we, as in Philadelphia, we see, unfortunately, everyday children with prolonged fasting times. And I think this can and should be reduced. And not just for the effect of blood pressure, but also for patient well-being and probably for many other things. And I do not really think that it's the anesthesia management that should be changed, but rather we should purposefully make more attention to keep fasting times relatively short. And this is even without changing good clinical practice, because good clinical practice recommendations are aiming for 1 or 2 hours spending on places. And if we could make this change and we could actively advocate for keeping these low fasting times, that could lead to quality improvement in our practice.
And Dr. Ruskitz, what do you think are the limitations of this study?
There are two major limitations, of course. One is, which we already extensively talking about, is we don't really know what hypertension means and what hypertension is in pediatric populations. So many more research needed on that subject before we could answer that appropriately. Of course, this is a retrospective kind of a chart review study, but again, doing on fasting prospective studies is quite difficult because adverse events other than potential hypertension are very, very rare, and it will be very difficult to conduct prospective studies on that.
So Dr. Sempal, based on the results of your study, what advice do you have for practitioners caring for pediatric patients in regards to fasting and blood pressure management? You don't have to give us a whole primer.
Yes, do we have another hour to... No, I'm just kidding. Based on our study, I believe that practitioners should consider taking a close look at their own fasting duration and hypotension patterns at their own institution. I agree with Dr. Vutskitz. The data, the studies, the literature on the effects of hypotension in children are still neither comprehensive nor clear. Practitioners and hospitals should be endeavoring to collect data on their fasting times, good quality data on their fasting durations, and discover how often children at their institutions are being subjected to prolonged fasting times, and whether they're trying to minimize hypotension or hypoglycemia, patient discomfort, or the many issues, any of the many issues that go along with prolonged fasting times. I think our study shows that despite a policy of clear fluid fasting up until 2 hours before a procedure, before induction of anesthesia, we still saw significant prolonged fasting durations that were also associated with extremely low blood pressure. And I would encourage practitioners at other institutions to examine the data and to consider quality improvement initiatives based on the literature that's out there, not just our study, but the other studies showing the deleterious effects of prolonged fasting, and endeavor to understand and improve prolonged fasting durations in their own patient populations.
I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article to learn more. Thank you, Dr. Simpalan Vutskits, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.